It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 79 for Friday, the 8th of June, 2012. On the show today, would you swallow a 35mm film in the name of art? No? Well, that's fine, because someone else has and we've seen the results. Google has also applied for a new domain, and you'll laugh out loud when you hear what it is, maybe. Plus, we've got the inside story behind the success of Minecraft and everything you need to know about this year's Gaming Uberfest E3. All that with Knobs On coming up. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langston here with me, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
Very nearly forgot your name then.
Charming.
Very nearly.
Only said it a few times.
And that third voice is, of course, our associate editor Olivia underscore Soul, and almost forgot your job title.
Well.
Now I remembered your name. It's fine. Actually, Liv just filed the craziest story about a crazy cat woman. Well, sort of.
Well, it was about an exchange program between crazy cat ladies and spa ladies, so that the spa ladies could get infected with a parasite called toxoplasmosis, which makes them more attractive to the opposite sex.
But it's really bizarre.
Yeah.
Just some of the things we're not actually going to be talking about on the podcast today. But anyway, let's climb into our scoop canoe and sail down this week's news rapids. Liv, I'm going to turn to you, actually. Swallowing film.
Yes.
What the H?
Well, this is a project by a couple of graphic design students at Kingston University. And they were given the brief of outdoor, one of those kind of arty briefs. And they decided they wanted to bring something on the inside to the outside. And the inside that they sought to bring to the outside was their digestive tract. So Luke Evans and Josh Lake are the name of the two guys. They're into photography. And so they swallowed 35mm film. To see what happened, and then they
photographic film. We should probably just point out
photographic film. They were warned that it was going to cause potential lacerations to their colons, though, so they had to put the film in special little capsules to make sure that didn't happen.
I see. And then they passed the film.
Yes.
After digesting it.
After fully digesting it, they had to collect the film at the other end.
Not fully digesting it, otherwise there wouldn't be much
to
collect.
Well, no, as in it had gone through the entire digestive system out of the bottom, the body. And they had to pick out the little capsules, wash the film contained within them, and then they examined it under an electron microscope. And what they've done is use those images, which show the kind of degradation which has occurred with all the kind of digestive juices. And they've taken these images of these highly kind of detailed images of what's happened, and they use that as their project.
Sort of brings a new meaning to the Kodak moment.
It does.
Doesn't it?
So what did these images look like after they passed through the digestive tract?
Well, to be honest, everything when looked under an electron microscope looks pretty awesome. You know, you've seen all those ones of dust mites and stuff look really cool. So it just looks, it just looks like a really rough surface. It's obviously eaten away at some of the gelatin and the emulsion layer of the film. But it's hard to know how that would compare to just regular process film.
Yeah, it'd be nice if they'd included some shots of that as well.
Yeah.
It's weird, though, because it's something that you can't do with digital.
No.
You know, not really. So if anything, you could say that this could be a business model for people who make film.
I suspect it's a fairly niche market, but yes, it could be indeed.
A little bit. Well, we've got some photos on the website. If you search Swallow Film on wired.co.uk, we've got a nice little gallery of, I don't know, poopy pictures, should we call them?
We could call them that, but you won't find them if you search for that.
No. No. Anyway, let's move on. Google has applied for several new top-level domains. Now, these are the domains like .com, .net, .org, .gov that exist to sort of tell the web browser something a little bit about the website. Is it commercial? Is it government? Is it English? Whatever. And the ones that Google has registered include .google, .youtube, and weirdly, .lol.
.lol?
.lol. Yeah. I mean, this makes a lot of sense when you look at it from one angle, because ICANN has begun letting people register these top-level domains, like specifically for cities and businesses and banks and things like that. And Google will just want to protect itself from trademark abuse and what have you. But Vint Cerf, who is Google's chief internet evangelist, came out and explained a little bit behind why they picked some of the domains that they've picked. So .google is fairly obvious. obvious one. We can skip past that. But they've also got .docs, because Google has a service called Google Docs, although it's actually now changed to Google Drive. So I'm not sure if they've just wasted a lot of money there. And then there are ones that, quote, improve user experience, such as .youtube. So apparently easier for finding channels. So we could have, you know, wired.youtube or something like that.
But what was his rationale for .lol?
Well, that's the thing. They said that they did .lol because Google sees these sorts of domains as, quote, having interesting and creative potential.
I wouldn't generally associate Google with the lols, would you?
Well, no, they do the April Fool thing every year. That's pretty
Everyone
cool.
Everyone does the April Fool thing year.
Google does them pretty well. Do you remember Pigeon Rank? Was it Pigeon Rank
they
did? Where it was pigeons nodding on a keyboard.
Penguin Rank?
I think it was Pigeon Rank. But anyway, they're really expensive, though, these things. I mean, we've talked about them a few times. Applications for each domain cost over £100,000 and require that the people who register them, or companies who register them, be in a position to manage this sort of top-level domain, which, again, is quite expensive, requires a lot of infrastructure. So it's a huge investment that Google's making. It's not like it costs 20 quid and they're just sort of getting a whole load so they can have some fun with it.
For Google, it sort of is 20 quid, though, isn't it?
Meanwhile, Duncan.
Up in the atmosphere.
Yes.
The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has reached 400 parts per million at some places in the Arctic.
Is that bad?
That is kind of bad, yes. It's the first time in, some scientists reckon, about 800,000 years that the Earth has seen carbon dioxide levels at this range.
Okay, and what does that actually mean for me? Like me, human Nate?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the greenhouse effect and how it works. What carbon dioxide does is it sits around the planet and it's a greenhouse gas. And greenhouse gases work by absorbing heat that's been emitted by the planet outward into space and then re-radiating that in all directions, okay?
Okay.
And what that means is that half of it carries on going up into space, but half of it goes straight back down to the surface and gets absorbed again. So it's like having a blanket over the planet.
Sure.
And the more of this gas we have in the atmosphere, the more that happens, and so the warmer the atmosphere becomes. That's physics. That's just atmospheric physics. That's how global warming works.
So this is to do with warmth, then. This high number is global warming, right?
This reflects kind of climate change or future climate change, because it's what drives climate change. Carbon dioxide is one of several greenhouse gases around. It's not the most effective, but like methane and CFCs have a much greater effect on a per molecule basis, but it is by far the most the most concentrated greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. There isn't so much methane in the atmosphere compared to carbon dioxide, and so carbon dioxide is the most important as a result.
Could this be something, though, more a milestone for sort of whipping people into shape and doing something about energy saving and carbon emissions, rather than it being a scientific milestone?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a scientific milestone at all. There's no actual difference. Well, there's a tiny difference. There's as much difference between 398 and 399 as there is between 399 and 400 from a scientific point of view. But it's more of a psychological one.
Yeah, it makes a good press release.
Well, yeah, kind of. I should note that globally, monitoring stations haven't quite reached that far. Globally, it's more like 395. It's only in Arctic areas that it's reached 400, but carbon dioxide does spread around the world quite quickly, so it won't be very, very long now before we do hit that 400 parts per million figure all around the world. It's kind of an interesting one, because what we'll probably see over the next few months is that dipping back down a little below 399 and 398, because as the Northern Hemisphere transitions into summer, trees will start photosynthesizing, and you know, the great coniferous forests of Siberia and Canada and Alaska,
I see,
will start churning that back into oxygen it's a kind of Sisyphean task, turning all of that carbon dioxide back into oxygen.
So it is a fluctuating figure.
It is, yeah, it changes throughout the year, and this is obviously the highest, it's, you know, the peak as we're coming out of spring and into summer. That's the highest peak that it's going to be.
So what does this actually mean? I mean, what can we do with this information?
Well, nothing especially. I mean, as I said before, it's more of a psychological milestone than a scientific one. But it could kind of spur future activity. But it's going to be all from here onward more about mitigation and about how we cope with the vast migration that climate change is going to cause, and how we deal with that on a policy level when, you know, huge, huge millions of people suddenly find that they can't live where they're living at the moment and have to migrate.
A good way to migrate might be to jog, mightn't it, Liv?
It might be, yes.
And if I needed assistance,
you could get a Jogobot.
What's a Jogobot? No one believe this isn't scripted.
A Jogobot is a new kind of robot jogging companion that has been developed by the Exertion Games Lab at the University of Melbourne.
That sounds like a fun lab.
I said Melbourne. Did I say that funny? Melbourne.
Melbourne.
Melbourne, yes.
Melbourne.
That's it. Melbourne. Yes, it's kind of a quadricopter. It's one of those parrot quadricopters that has been kind of hacked a little bit to make it this Jogobot. And what you have to do is the runner has to wear a special T-shirt with a little kind of AR, augmented reality marker on it. And the flying jogging robot will accompany you on your trip following that marker on your T-shirt. And you can kind of set it to various different levels, to either really ambitious, speedy running level, and that's the trainer mode, or it can just be there as a kind of companion.
I see. So it is kind of like a personal trainer. Well, sort of. It's like
Sort of, yeah. And the idea is that it's a kind of physical running companion for when you don't have a human to run with, which sounds a little bit sad.
Well, it does. But on the other hand, I did see in the paper the other day, someone strapped a dead cat to a quadricopter.
Well, quite.
So
quite
I could see these two things coming together.
Yeah, the only problem is their battery lasts just 20 minutes. So that's a pretty short run by most people's standards.
Can you control it when you're running?
At the moment, no. You have to kind of grab it down and control it that way, which isn't particularly satisfactory. So
it means you could end all your jogs with a long jump.
Yeah, well, the plan is to try and introduce some gesture controls. So I hope perhaps you could introduce the long jump or the star jump as the pause mode.
My favourite thing is the kind of mental image that this conjures up, just people running along being chased by these quadricopters.
Yeah.
And is it something we can buy? Is it a project, isn't it?
It's a prototype at the moment, but they are selling it, I think, already. So you
All right.
can
search for Jogobot.
Yeah.
There you go.
Excellent.
Other things to jog away from include mosquitoes.
Yes, that's right. And you wouldn't want to run away from one across a motorway, would you?
Oh, no.
No.
Well,
because,
maybe.
Well, a motorway filled with trucks going very, very fast.
No, it'd be dangerous.
No, it'd be very dangerous indeed. But every time a mosquito goes for a little fly through the rain, it's the equivalent of running across a motorway. Raindrops weigh about 50 times as much as a mosquito does, and they fall so fast that it's impossible for the insects to avoid them. And when one hits one, the mosquitoes get smacked downwards with a force about 300 times that of gravity.
Oh, I do feel sorry for them. Honestly, they're flying around, they're trying to infect people with vicious diseases, you know, and they're getting hit by...
I don't think they're trying to do that.
Well, so a mosquito getting hit by a raindrop is like a man running across a motorway getting hit by a truck.
Kind of, except that the mosquito survives.
Yeah, why?
Every time. Well, a team at the Georgia Institute of Technology wanted to find that out, so they hooked up high-speed cameras to this kind of flight arena thing, which was this acrylic cage covered with mesh, about 20 centimetres tall, that they then squirted jets of water at to simulate raindrops at terminal velocity. And they filled up this cage full of mosquitoes, six mosquitoes, and subjected these mosquitoes to these jets of water. And they found out that when they were hit, all six of them managed to recover from these impacts without hitting the floor of the cage. So they've been smacked with a force up to 300 times that of gravity, and they fall less than 20 centimetres before recovering.
That's impressive.
It is really impressive.
Must be something to do with them having wings that are also bigger than their bodies.
Well, kind of. It's more about the body structure. They found out with this kind of filming that most of these raindrops hit them with glancing blows, and when that happened, they were sent spinning away, you know, pitching and yawing in all kinds of different directions. But even when they were hit directly, they only fell about 20 body lengths before recovering. And what it is they think that this is because of the insect's very, very low mass compared to the raindrops. Because the raindrop imparts so little force onto the mosquito when it hits, because the mosquito weighs so little, it doesn't actually hurt the mosquito very much. It just pushes it downwards very fast, and then as soon as it has the ability to kind of scramble out the way, it does, which it does very quickly, and then it can recover. It doesn't, you know, lose much speed or momentum or anything like that, so there's no actual force involved.
But having a low mass compared to a much larger item doesn't seem to work well for anyone else.
No, and that's because of g-forces. What's really, really interesting is that these g-forces, which are up to 300 g's, they're the highest ever recorded acceleration that animals have survived.
Whereas
humans, they can only sort of survive, I think, about 2.5-3 g's before they start going unconscious. Mosquitoes, 300, absolutely fine.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And so it's this kind of rapid acceleration that they're capable of withstanding that allows them to survive these raindrops.
But presumably they don't have internal organs to kind of slosh around inside your body and the kind of internal skeleton.
They're rather more simple creatures than humans are. But this isn't really about allowing humans to run across a motorway.
No.
It's more about allowing micro airborne vehicles to survive rainstorms and things like that. They're hoping that future miniature surveillance drones used by the military the size of mosquitoes will not be troubled so much when there is a rainstorm.
Thank you mosquitoes. Well, we're gonna buzz through a little ad break now, but when we come back we're gonna find out the inside story about how Minecraft became such a success from the man who's just spent the weekend partying with Notch.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Right, we're going to move on to talking about something else, still games related, but from a slightly different angle. You may have heard of Minecraft. It's kind of been a blockbuster success from an independent studio. A guy called Notch created it with his team. One of the biggest stories in the new issue of our magazine, you may have heard of it, it's called Wired. It sort of goes behind the scenes of Minecraft and its studio and Notch. And it's written by a guy called Tom Cheshire, who is in the studio, conveniently enough. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Nate.
Thanks for joining us. Now, Duncan, you are a massive fan of Minecraft. You seem to think
I've played it quite a lot.
The bee's knees.
It is the bee's knees.
Just firstly, like, why is this game important?
It's virtual Lego. It isn't a game that tells you a story. It's a game that lets you create your own story. Stories happen around you while you're playing it.
Yeah, I'd say it's just what it offers is infinite creativity rather than a sort of on rails first person shooter where you're guided from action scene to action scene. You make what you want of it. And I think there's been a great yearning for that from gamers, and Notch was sort of the person who untapped that and let it flow.
Where did Minecraft come from in the first place? How did that the game take shape?
Notch was playing some other games and just started mashing them up together, and this kind of just came organically. And he wouldn't say this directly, but he grew up in sort of rural Sweden, right in the middle of nowhere. He spent his whole time sort of exploring the woods, getting lost with friends. So I think that desire to explore is something that he feels very deeply. And he's not one of the ones, when he plays a game, to create these towering edifices that you see. He just likes sort of mining through until you find a cave with lava flows, which for me as well is the greatest thrill of the game. Like, first time I stumbled across a lava flow underground, this huge underground cavern, it's proper childlike wonder,
yeah.
Which I haven't really had, and you don't get from sort of Battlefield or Call of Duty.
But you went over to Mojang's studios, the company that makes Minecraft. I mean, what's the culture like over there? What's he like?
So when I went, it's still small. It's about 20 people working there. Very relaxed games developers shooting Nerf guns at each other, drinking a lot of Red Bull.
So they are shooting men in the office, just not in the game.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously there's a deep-seated need to shoot people, and they just get rid of it then with foam bullets. But I mean, they're growing so fast. This story moves so fast, and I was reporting, when I was there, they just passed 5 million in sales. Before we went on sale, they're already up to 6 million. They launched on Xbox and smashed all sorts of records. They're profitable within an hour on Xbox, I think.
Yeah, I heard that. Like, they made their money back from development in an hour.
Yeah, it's insane. And they've got all the merchandise coming in. So now they've moved to bigger offices, which I haven't visited. They've got Swedish House Mafia to open it for them. Deadmau5, their friend, is coming to play. they're just having a huge amount of fun.
It sounds like kind of celebrity lifestyle.
I think he's keen to separate Notch, the persona, and Marcus Persson, the person.
The person.
But, yeah, so he says he gets recognised in Sweden about sort of 4 times a week. And he's the politest person you've ever met, like, unfeignedly. And he deals with the world, but I think this is why he's really scared of making another hit in some respects. Like, this has changed his life, and he just wants to make games. That's what his passion is, and that's what he always set out to do. So anything that gets in the way of that, like people asking him questions while he's making games, like, he's got this, when he looks up, this sort of I'm going to murder you face if you're interrupting him coding. So I think that's what he's all about, really.
And what's kind of interesting about Minecraft, the most interesting thing, is that he just basically built it in his bedroom, and it's become this, we said it just sold 6 million copies at least 10 euros a copy. So he's made more than 60 million euros from this. Yeah. My math is a little deficient there for a second. But yeah, and so, like, what does this mean for the games industry, like, longer term?
I think it's kind of the same sort of things we saw with the iPhone. This indie, there's a lot of people raising money or making money from indie games, which we've seen, and I talked about in the article. The problem becomes one of discovery. So Notch is an established name. Anything that he says is good will probably sell well. But in terms of finding the new Minecraft, this next developer, it'll become much, much harder, I think, to have that kind of success. And I think that success was a product of the time, and probably wouldn't happen again today, even with the same game, as good as it is.
So how did he kind of break through that gap from being somebody who nobody had ever heard of? You know, who's this Notch guy?
He went with the early adopter model. So he released it as a really basic game and started talking about it on TIGSource, which is a forum for independent gamers. And the people who played it first were other games developers. They all chipped in, very vocal, and started doing like that. And then every week he'd update the game. And when you update it, you bring new features in. People talk about it more. Maybe they'll tell a friend, or maybe people be paying it, and then they'll be pushed over to the point where they actually buy it and go for it. It's also a great way of sort of stopping piracy as well if your game's constantly evolving.
So instead of having kind of like a completely closed development process where it's kept under absolute secrecy, it was entirely open the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, anyone could have come along and nicked that idea straight away. It's the same.
And several people have.
Yeah, but just no one's done it quite as well. I mean, he really understands game mechanics and game design in a way that I don't think can be taught. But it's the same with what we're seeing, so people raising money on Kickstarter. If you put an idea on Kickstarter, someone could nick that straight away. And that's the swap you make. Like, you choose openness and transparency. That's what I was going for. In the hope that it'll raise awareness, raise publicity, and also create a very loyal following, versus closed, where you can keep everything to yourself and then bamboozle them. But then that might go horribly, horribly wrong.
So in the sort of process of reporting this story and traveling around, what was the most surprising thing that you learnt, either about Mojang or Minecraft or the development or Notch or whatever?
I think, because I spent the entire weekend with them in proper games development style. They're making a game from scratch over 60 hours, and that's kind of what I was expected. A lot of junk food, including a Viking kebab pizza. which is what it sounds like. But the best part was when we finished and sort of we all went out on the town together, had a few drinks, just walking into this club. It's a very glamorous nightclub in the center of Stockholm. And I was like, oh, this is fun. Notch walks in, gets like amazing table, because he's loaded. But really generous with it, like treating everyone to drinks. But like the weird thing was how many people like these sort of, you know, kind of like, I don't know if they're B-list celebrities in Stockholm, but they look like that sort of dress. We'll just come over and shake his hand. This sort of bearded, like, big games developer. That was really weird, seeing those two worlds interface and realizing this wasn't just something that has a very niche appeal. It's actually spread beyond that.
Well, Tom, I think it's an awesome feature. I'm personally on the fence with Minecraft in as much as I played it, tried to get into it and can't. But it's a really interesting feature, I think, even if you're not into Minecraft. And it's on... Is it out now? It's out now, isn't
it? It is out now. And on the internet, is that... Am I saying that right?
Oh, it is on the website as well, actually.
The website, yeah. Yeah. Is that also in print as
this
well?
This internet
with lovely
thing
pictures.
You might have heard of.
Yeah. Yeah, we love the internet.
Okay, well, we love you. We love the print. Cool. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Staying on the topic of gaming, though, E3...
It's been an interesting week for games, hasn't it?
It's been the big week of the year for games. The E3 conference is kind of where all the big manufacturers and gaming makers get together, certainly most of them and all the big ones, to announce what they're doing over the next 12 months.
Well, you say all the big ones, but Blizzard aren't there and Valve aren't there and a bunch of other people aren't there.
Most of the big ones are there. And we're going to talk about the PC stuff, but some interesting announcements coming out. I want to talk the first one about something Microsoft announced called Smart Glass for the Xbox, which is basically letting the Xbox experience get into the tablet space. So you could be playing... Duncan, think about this. You're playing Halo, right?
That's not a likely situation.
On the Xbox. You're shooting someone. They die. They drop an item. You walk over it. Your tablet lights up with rudimentary information about the item. It doesn't take you away from the Xbox shooty kill experience. It's just beeping away on your phone. An item is here. You've got a message from your commander. Oh, better get out my Windows phone.
So then you have to pause and have a look at your...
Well, that's
tablet.
The idea, is that it's all kind of integrated. But yeah, you probably would...
But what's quite cool about this is it isn't just Windows Phone, because when I read this to start with, I thought it was just going to be Microsoft saying it's only going to work with our things. But doesn't this also work on Android tablets and iPhones and iPads and things like that? Which is, it's such a good thing.
They named iPad and Android as well as Windows Phone in the announcement, so we don't know exactly what form it will take on those devices, but certainly it's in the plan for what they announced. I think that's pretty cool. And also it becomes a new way to interact with the Xbox. So you have your tablet as kind of like a giant... touchpad. So if you're browsing movies and stuff on the Xbox, instead of having to shout connect or use your controller, you can just swipe it with your on your touchscreen or something, or type it in.
Mm. I think it would be quite difficult for like games developers to implement this in a way that isn't too gimmicky. I think in a lot of cases it will be like, oh, you've picked up a box, swipe on your tablet to open the box.
It sounds quite useful for kind of kids' games, you know, where you might, and perhaps with Kinect and things like that, where you might want to be holding a map or, you know, some kind of extra
I think a map is a really cool thing. Like, yeah. That's I think, the best example of this stuff, where you'll be, you know, navigating around some map, some level on the screen,
yeah.
And you can look down at your knees where your tablet is to see where you are and which direction you could be heading in, or objectives or something like that.
Yeah, like Google Maps, zoom in and tap on an area on the tablet and your on-screen character goes there.
I think that's one of the most powerful things, but I can't quite shake the suspicion that this might ever only be in about five games.
Well, one of the games that was talked about quite a bit was the new South Park game, which I'm massively looking forward to.
This is an RPG, isn't it?
Yes. You get to take the role of a new kid in town. It's going to be called The Stick of Truth. It's a South Park Studios game. It's all written and produced and voiced and everything by the regular South Park cast. It's going to be out later this year, hopefully in time for Christmas. And it looks awesome. It looks like you're playing a giant episode of South Park, but with RPG elements.
Have they made games before?
They have made games before, yeah. I mean, they've actually recently released one on the Xbox called Tenement's Revenge, I think it was called, which is just kind of quite a small downloadable platformer. They did one several years ago for the Nintendo 64 and PlayStation. It was kind of like a 3D South Park adventure game sort of thing that was quite good fun, but never really made... It didn't really feel like you were playing South Park, whereas this looks exactly like you're playing South Park. It's quite funny. Trey Parker, I think, and Matt Stone, who are giving the presentation at E3.
Who are the creators of South Park,
of South Park, said that it was really hard to kind of bring that traditional crappy South Park look to an Xbox game. So I thought that was pretty neat. Actually, I've got a soundbite of from the conference, because the very, very first thing they did when they came on stage was to take the mickey out of what Microsoft had just announced. This is a clip.
Hi. How many times have you been watching an episode of South Park and thought, I'd like to be able to watch this on my television while hooked into my mobile device, which is being controlled by my tablet device, which is hooked into my oven, all while sitting in the refrigerator? Well, we're not doing that. We're just doing this game. It's an RPG.
Can't do that with our game, no.
Harsh words.
But there weren't any new consoles at all, were there? We saw some new stuff from the Wii U.
Yeah, the
Nintendo's Nintendo's latest project.
The Wii U. We weren't expecting new consoles. Maybe next year. The only thing that was really shown off like that was, as you say, the Wii U, which is Nintendo's new console. It's not out yet, but they have announced it in the past. And it's kind of got... It's like the Wii, but it's got this kind of controller where it's got a screen on it. So you can...
Just like a tablet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot like a tablet. And I've heard it's only got like a 3-hour battery life, which is going to be a bit of a problem. Mm. So they showed off that a bit, which is quite cool.
And a bunch of games as well.
A bunch of games to go along with it. And they're getting some decent titles.
Yeah,
they're getting
Mario and various other things.
But they're also getting Mass Effect 3 on the Wii, which is quite cool, I think. And
Years after everyone else has had it.
Yeah.
Poor Nintendo.
We're not that very bothered. But I have to say, what struck me most about E3 this year was just how incredibly violent all the games were. And what was even weirder, actually, is that in the conference, they would beep out the swearing in the South Park trailer, but left in a clip of a man getting stabbed in the head. And I thought, it's weird.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, E3's been getting kind of like increasingly, quote, core gaming, unquote. And generally what that means is people being shot in the face with big guns and people going, and hiding behind, you know, waist-high walls. And it's just all about this kind of like very stereotypical, very male-focused sort of side of gaming. And gaming itself has actually been departing quite significantly from that over the last couple of years. We've seen the big mobile social movement. We've seen indie games doing incredibly interesting, creative things. And there doesn't seem to be any place for those things at E3. Do you think that's a problem for the show longer term?
I don't think it's a problem for the show, but I think it's a problem for the industry. Mm-hmm. I think that we need a mobile gaming conference because there's so much going on there.
Shouldn't that be representative of all gaming?
Yeah, exactly. Shouldn't Zynga be having booths at E3
you asked me whether it's a problem for the show. I don't think the show will suffer.
But you said it's a problem for the industry. You're saying that it's a problem for the industry that they don't want to be at this conference?
Well, you could look at it two ways. I think the conference will be fine. There's plenty of stuff there, you know, to play with, but it could be better, yeah. And the industry as a whole should probably be lobbying for more PC support, more mobile gaming support, from the conference. But then I think, well, does it not get a bit too big?
So hang on, which games that you were talking about specifically are particularly violent?
Pretty much all of them. Tomb Raider is a good example. You're sort of used to Tomb Raider and sort of shooting animals in a cave. I mean, this was like a young Lara Croft running down a field, running down a track, shooting a guy in the face with an arrow, and then stabbing another guy in the throat with an arrow, and then setting a whole bunch of guys on fire. And I'm thinking, Lara, calm down, girl. Seriously.
You've changed.
She has been shooting T-Rexes for years.
Yeah, I know, but,
you know, so that was quite apparent. And same for a lot of the games, you know, Splinter Cell and the Tom Clancy game and obviously Modern Warfare and stuff like that. It was just, when you watch on the presentation, it's like this massive cinema display of just horrible violence after horrible violence. And while that in itself doesn't bother me, when it's exclusively that and they're censoring out swearing and there's, you know, there's no daft nudity games that are being shown off, really. It's like, it seems very one-sided, and it felt like the focus this year was massive sequels to not original IP and violent ones.
Man shooters.
That was my takeaway point.
Games about shooting men. I mean, one of the funniest things I saw is somebody highlighted on Twitter was that there was this really, really good-looking game being shown off, and everyone was going, "Oh my god, you know, this is a next-gen game and everything." And this person, I want to credit them, but I can't remember exactly who it was mentioned it, but they were just like, "No, it's just running on a PC, and the PC is so far away now from the current console generation that anything that's running on it looks next generation to people who aren't sort of familiar with the power of the platform."
Well, we've got loads of E3 content on the site. If you go to wired.co.uk/E3 2012, or one word, you will find our topic hub full of all the most interesting things, videos, screenshots, all that kind of stuff. We've had some good feedback this week. First from Darren Murphy, who says, "Hello, as a teacher, Chromebooks..." This is because we were talking about Chromebooks the other week in the other show. "Chromebooks have a lot of appealing attributes. Chiefly among these are the fast boot-up time in a classroom, quick access to docs and online resources is great for streamlining the learning process."
And I guess kids are less likely to get distracted as well by other apps.
Well, possibly.
Apart from, what, the internet?
I was going to say kids, it's less likely.
I suppose.
Because we were talking about how the Chromebook, Google's Chromebook, would be really useful in a business establishment because all the secret information or sensitive information isn't stored on the laptop itself. So if you got it lost, it wouldn't be the end of the world. And Darren's pointing out that in a school, there are similar benefits.
No excuses for your computer crashing and losing your homework either.
We also had a lovely note from Ryan Bilau, who says that for the first time since the birth of my son, I'm reading the current issue of my subscription to Wired. Is that newsworthy? I would say, yes, it absolutely is. And congratulations.
Definitely. Yeah, and hello to Finn, yes. The son in question.
Congratulations and hello, Finn. We like a bit of baby news.
Welcome to the future, Finn.
Yes, read Wired. I think on that note, we're going to wrap things up. Liv, how do people want to get in touch if they've just had a baby and want us to give it a shout out?
Well, there are multiple ways.
I don't know if this is going to be a regular feature, but
I don't think this is exclusively for people who've just had babies or for babies themselves, but you can give us a call on 0208 123 0468 from a landline or a mobile, and you'll be charged at the UK local rate. You can also call us on Skype. We're on Wired UK Podcast, all one word, and that's obviously for free. And you can follow us on Twitter, where we are always tweeting some deliciously bite-sized nuggets of gold. It's at Wired UK. And then we have our Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK.
Hit us up. Are you a baby? Have you learned how to type? Send us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. Subject line, baby here. I think it's time to go.
Yeah.
Probably.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye. You'll be watching the live stream with your excitement pants on, won't you?
I will be. Yes.